Congratulations, you got the nomination. Now, about the global economy. From American Public Media, this is Marketplace. In Los Angeles, I'm Kai Rizdahl. It is Wednesday today, the 8th day of June. Good to have you along, everybody. It is the day after the end of the presidential primary cycle of 2016. And we're going to talk about the finances of what happens now that we're in general election land in just a minute here. First, though, this item of interest, possibly to the winner in November. The first time a Clinton ran for the White House, the mantra was, it's the economy, stupid. The World Bank would like to submit its alternative for this time round. It's the global economy, y'all. The bank's forecast cuts its 2016 global growth estimate down to 2.4%. And to be clear, there are many in Washington who would be thrilled to tiny little bits at a 2.5% growth rate here. But that new global number from the World Bank is A, lower than predictions from a lot of the other biggies like the IMF and the OECD. And second, it's the latest in that string to be revised down. Marketplace's Mark Garrison starts us off.
Different countries, different challenges. Low commodity prices hit emerging economies. Europe and Japan are still hurting. And this year started off badly for the U.S. Ihan Kuza is the lead author of the World Bank's latest report.
What these numbers mean is the global economy is still trying to recover from this low, weak growth it is trapped into.
His team also cut its forecast for America's growth. That puts it in line with the National Association for Business Economics. NABE's members are dialing back their outlook for 2016 American growth to 1.8%, largely because they're worried businesses aren't investing enough. Lisa Emsbo-Mattingly is a research director at Fidelity Investments and the president of NABE. Of particular concern to economists, uncertainty about the presidential election.
If I'm a business person making decisions about hiring and investing, if I see quite a bit of uncertainty on the horizon in terms of policies, whether it's trade policy, immigration policy, labor policy, I'm going to hold off.
None of these lower forecasts alone are signs of doom, says Justin Wolfers, professor of economics at University of Michigan.
It's a case not for pessimism, but for less optimism. So things are going to keep getting better. It just means they may not keep getting better at the pace we're hoping for.
Predicting that pace is tough, especially in the wake of a historic crash like 2008, says Nariman Baravesh, chief economist at IHS.
What you're seeing here is, and this is true of most forecasters, including the World Bank, is that every year they think next year growth is going to recover, and then every year it doesn't, so they have to cut back their forecast.
For what it's worth, economists do see growth speeding up in 2017, but we won't know for sure until later. In New York, I'm Mark Garrison for Marketplace.
One never knows. It is almost certainly all over, but the shouting for the primaries this year, Clinton v. Trump, will be the major party headlines for the next 5 months of our collective existence. The primary campaign that got us here, though, was quite the pricey affair. According to the Federal Election Commission, candidates have spent more than $700 million so far, that is presidential candidates only, on both sides. And it doesn't even count the hundreds of millions raised and spent by outside groups. Marketplace's Kimberly Adams reports from Washington that the general election we are now embarked upon is going to throw a bunch more zeros on there.
Ads, travel, campaign mailers, and phone banks are expensive enough a couple of states at a time. But now the candidates are going to have to go big, really big. Josh Stewart is with the Sunlight Foundation, which tracks money in politics.
A lot of estimates have each candidate, and that includes the candidate and their respective parties, are going to have to raise and spend at least $1 billion each.
That's billion with a B. Clinton and Trump have other things in common as well, like strong ties to New York and Wall Street.
The GOP will give the Democrats a run for their money when it comes to Wall Street cash.
Both candidates also have to deal with the lack of unity in their parties. Trump isn't exactly on the best terms with the GOP and its donors, something he didn't have to worry about in the primaries, says Meredith McGehee of the Campaign Legal Center.
That's obviously going to change in the general. And so I would expect a fair amount from the candidates, but of course these outside groups are going to play a really dominant role as well.
On the Democratic side, Bernie Sanders says he'll keep fighting, so his donor lists are still his for now. Michael Meese is a professor emeritus at DePaul University and says Clinton will have to tread carefully.
I think she needs Bernie's support, but I don't think she needs it from a financial perspective.
He says Clinton is pretty good on cash, but needs the energy and enthusiasm of the Sanders supporters. But with so much money on both sides, Meese says we can expect to see a lot of ads this campaign, and probably not very nice ones.
So it's going to be a very expensive race, and it's going to be a very, very nasty race.
So get ready, everyone. It's still a ways to go until November. In Washington, I'm Kimberly Adams for Marketplace.
The Dow closed above 18,000 today for the first time since April. That and $2.75 American will get you on the subway. We'll have the details when we do the numbers. Let's tick them off on our fingers, shall we? We have covered the looming UK vote on Brexit, whether Britain should leave the European Union or stay. We have covered it by looking at American expats working over there. We've covered it by looking at what it would mean for the City of London, capital T, capital C, Britain's financial center. And today, by looking at regular old British businesses. It's arguably an existential question for some of them anyway. Would they be better off in a tariff-free single market of 500 million people, or would they prosper more out, free from the constraints of EU regulation? From the county of Dorset, on the south coast of England, Marketplace's Stephen Beard has that story.
Manufacturing bridges and other steel structures, the company John Reed & Son is a great British export success story.
To date, we've exported into near 140 countries across the world.
The chief executive, Simon Boyd, says that success does not extend to the vast single market on Britain's doorstep.
In the last 10 years, I think we've done one job in Europe.
The EU is supposed to be a single market, one territory for its member states with no internal borders or other obstacles restricting the free flow of goods and services. It isn't, claims Boyd.
We're prevented from working in France, for example. Because to be able to do our skill in France, you have to supply an insurance that can only be bought by French companies, and it's just rampant protectionism.
So as far as you're concerned, the single market is a sham.
It is a sham.
And he says because he is bound by costly EU regulations, it hampers his export drive into countries outside Europe.
Because we're exporting against, we're competing against America, China, India, Australia, all of whom don't have to go through any of the hoops we have to go through to comply with EU directives and regulation.
But here's a British exporter with a totally different point of view.
I am sailing.
Not Rod Stewart, but a man who once sold him a pair of bright pink trousers. Tom Cridland launched his fashion business 2 years ago. He now turns over $1 million a year and says exporting to the EU is easy. He dreads the prospect of a Brexit.
Well, I'm strongly against it. I think that the Tom Cridland brand would be destroyed if Brexit were to happen.
He sells what he calls durable clothing, guaranteed to last for 30 years, physically, if not fashionably. The only supplier he trusts is Portuguese. Brexit, he fears, would lead to import tariffs on his products when he brings them into Britain.
If we had to pay import duty on them, we wouldn't be able to offer such an accessible price point. We offer luxury clothing at an accessible price point, and we would no longer be able to do so, I don't think. My business would probably be gone after a few months.
That's just part of all the scaremongering, say the Brexit supporters on the campaign trail.
I think that they're rattled on the Remain side of the campaign because they're putting out more propaganda.
Brexit backers say there would be no tariffs because the UK would swiftly negotiate a special trade deal with the EU. But Britain's largest business group, the CBI, is sceptical about that and says the group's Andy Bagnall, so is the vast majority of its members.
Pretty consistently, about 8 out of 10 of our members have said that their business is best served by the United Kingdom voting to remain in the European Union.
Brexit backers have been hammered from on high. A whole string of national and international bodies, businesses and foreign leaders have all warned the UK that leaving the EU would be a step into the dark and most likely a disaster. Here at his Steelworks Brexit supporter, Simon Boyd is unbowed in spite of the weight of opposition.
The Bank of England, the IMF, the CBI, the President of the United States, they're all wrong and you're right.
Yeah, they are all wrong. And yes, I am right. You know, we're a great British people and a great nation. This will be anything but a step into the dark. It will be a leap into the light.
With one bound, British business could be free or in deep trouble. In London, I'm Stephen Beard for Marketplace.
We take some time every now and then to check in with some of our regulars, people making a go of it out there in the American economy. We did tariffs and global trade a couple of weeks ago with our steel person. Today, it's catfish and global trade. Our go-to catfish guy is Townsend Kaiser. He runs, as you might remember, Kaiser Family Farms with his dad down in Greensboro, Alabama. And this is, as it turns out, a good time to talk catfish because there are some fish inspection rules changes in the wind. Townsend, it's good to talk to you again.
Good to talk to you, Kai. How are you today?
I'm well. How's business since we were down there last year-ish sometime?
Business is good. We have sold most of our crop, and it has warmed back up, and we are feeding, growing another one.
Have you sold all those ones? All those ones that we saw when we were down there, they're all gone, right?
They're all gone, and hopefully in some consumers' mouths, and hope they're enjoying them.
One of the reasons we called, other than checking in to see how you are, is to ask you about this catfish inspection bill that's up on Capitol Hill, and what's going on with that? They were going to end catfish inspections of foreign catfish. You're obviously opposed. What's going on?
Very much so. We aren't asking as catfish producers for any special treatment. We just want to be on the same playing field, and we welcome inspection and want to have a solid stamp behind our fish. And we were looking out for the American consumer, making sure they get a healthy product, because that's the most important thing.
Talk to me for a minute about your foreign competition. It comes mostly from Vietnam, right? How much of it do you worry about?
I worry a lot about it, because we know since FSIS inspection took over about 3 months ago.
Remind us what FSIS means.
Food Safety Inspection Service.
Okay.
They are part of USDA, and since they started inspecting imported fish, they have found several loads that have elevated levels of known carcinogens, which we know to be present in the conditions where they raise fish. And I'm concerned about the American public as well as myself, especially because we don't need their tainted fish being confused with our fish.
When you drive along those catfish ponds that we drove by when we were down there last year, how often do you think to yourself, man, I'm just a catfish farmer in Greensboro, Alabama, and I'm having to worry about the global economy?
A lot.
Really?
A lot. We're all part of a puzzle, and we all need to do our part, but, you know, you start messing up little chains in the puzzle, and sooner or later it's going to unravel. And food is very important to us as a country. I mean, we need to sustain our food supply.
Yeah. Let me ask you the politics question of this. You guys, the catfish association, you guys have a fish fry up in D.C. every year, right?
Yes.
You sort of get people to sort of raise awareness, yeah?
We do. In about 2 weeks, we're having one.
I imagine this year that fish fry is going to be a little bit more important to you than it has been in the past.
I think so. I'm looking forward to going up to Washington and talking about some of our issues with not just our legislators who are with us, but some of the ones from surrounding states, and love to hear their views and opinions on this.
You can do that same breading mixture you made for me while I was down there?
Because
that was really good.
Yes, sir. I plan on it.
And I would vote for you if you fed me that food. I'm just saying.
Well, I appreciate that.
Townsend Kaiser, he is our catfish farmer down in Greensboro, Alabama. Townsend, thanks very much.
Good talking to you again today.
All right, talk soon. Coming up.
Well, it's interesting. I really wasn't much of a fan of surveys.
Customer satisfaction surveys, to be clear here. The thing is, that was the guy who pretty much invented them. First, though, let's do the numbers. The Dow Industrial is up 66 points today, a 3rd percent, 18,005. The NASDAQ up 12 points, a 0.25%, 49.74. The S&P 500 gained a 3rd percent, 6 points, ended things at 21.19. Oil prices continued to climb up above $51 a barrel. Energy stocks, however, did not always follow. Marathon Oil gave back 0.6% today. Chevron eased 0.2%. Exxon, though, up just a fraction. In technology, Apple announced it would introduce search ads to the App Store. A, boring, and B, come on, really? The stock slipped about a 0.1%. Alphabet, parent company of Google, clicked up 1.6% today. Facebook took home about a 0.5%. Amazon up 0.4%. Twitter, though, still reeling from more executive changes. Declined, take your pick. It did both. About a 3rd percent. Bond prices rose. The yield on the 10-year T-note fell to 1.70%. Ever lower. You're listening to Marketplace. This is Marketplace. I'm Kai Rizdahl. Yahoo, of which much has been said lately, not much of it promising, is actively engaged in trying to sell itself off, as you know. We talked a little bit about this yesterday. The company is also looking to divest a portfolio of more than 3,000 patents and patents pending. The company calls it, and this is a quote, a unique opportunity to acquire some of the most pioneering and foundational patents related to web search and advertising. The Wall Street Journal says Yahoo hopes to get more than $1 billion for them, including its original search technology dating back to 1996. 3,000 patents might seem like a whole lot of patents to let loose, but oh, what a business they are. Marketplace's Annie Baxter has that one.
In recent years, it's becoming increasingly common for companies like Yahoo to unload a big trove of patents. That's according to Doug Lichtman, a law professor at the University of California, Los Angeles.
Companies that are having trouble maybe in their core business, but really did something, right? Really did pioneer something new and important, these companies realize, hey, I can sell my patents and at least get paid for what I achieved.
And it's not uncommon for firms to be sitting on a lot of patents they're not getting a return on. So says patent attorney Mullen Shaw at Envision IP. Shaw says there are a lot of potential patent buyers. He says in past sales, Yahoo has sold patents to companies that could benefit from the technology.
Companies like Snapchat, LinkedIn, who may not have their own patent portfolios or may not have patents dating back as far as Yahoo's.
He says firms might also buy patents defensively, like Google's acquisition of Motorola a few years ago, which included mobile patents.
In the event that, say, Google was sued by Apple, Google would then have a large trove of patents that they could use to countersue Apple with.
And then there are trolls, companies that buy patents to license them or sue other companies for infringing on them. In terms of the resale value of patents, Harvard University innovation expert Josh Lerner says that can be really hard to determine.
The challenge of valuing patents is that it's almost like valuing works of art.
He says for every Van Gogh, there are a lot more mundane items on the auction block. I'm Annie Baxter for Marketplace.
Game 3 of the NBA Finals is tonight. Golden State Warriors and Steph Curry, Cleveland Cavaliers and LeBron James. The fans are pretty excited, as they should be. The players, they're probably pretty tired, as they should be. 80-something regular season games starting last October, plus a couple of 3 rounds of playoffs, is a whole lot of hoops. At least they're getting paid for the extra work, right? Marketplace's Andy Euler tells us it's not that simple.
The way NBA contracts work, you sign a deal to get paid a certain amount each year. The regular season starts in October and ends in April, 82 games. But if you make the playoffs, that could be another 28 games. So the more games you play, the more money you make, right?
You're essentially working for free.
That's Mike Leeds. He's a sports economist at Temple University. He says, in fact, the more playoff games you play, the less money per game you're making. The way the NBA set it up, it put aside a lump sum to be split between all the teams that make the playoffs. This year, it'll be about $15 million. That's $15 million.
There's a set payment for the winners, a set payment for the losers, and that's it. And it doesn't matter whether it goes four games that are blowouts or seven games that go into overtime.
Better way to put it, it's a bonus. But somebody's got to be making money from more games. Larry Kuhn writes for ESPN.com. He says the real winners in the playoffs are broadcasters and the NBA.
Would the league itself love for every series to go seven games? Of course. And then it's raking in more advertising dollars.
He says those advertising dollars certainly bring more money to the league, and eventually players will see that money.
But it's circuitous. It's indirect in the way they get it.
Now, I'm not asking you to feel bad for the players if this series gets pushed to another game. But just know they're not banking on that series going seven. At least, not immediately. I'm Andy Euler for Marketplace.
I was at the hardware store this past weekend, and for the umpteenth time, really every time I go in there actually, the cashier gave me my receipt, circled the thing down at the bottom, and said, "Take our customer survey. You'll have a chance to win $50. Great. If those ubiquitous customer satisfaction surveys bug you like they do some of us, I feel your pain. But also, we know who to thank. His name is Fred Reichheld. He invented the customer satisfaction survey, now found at checkout stands, fine retail establishments, and definitely in your inbox. He's a fellow and a consultant at Bain & Company. We got him on the phone to talk things over about this. Mr. Reichel, thanks for coming on the program.
Thank you very much.
14 years ago, you invent this new way for us to figure out brand loyalty. Why did you do that?
Well, it's interesting. I really wasn't much of a fan of surveys. At Bain & Company, where I've worked for so long, we like financial results. So we looked at customer behaviors that were indicators of loyalty, things like coming back for more, repeat purchase, recommending to friends. And long story short, we came up with a two-question survey, essentially one and then an explanation that would get to the core of, have we earned your loyalty and how could we do a better job next time?
But here's the thing. Every time you turn around now, there's a customer satisfaction survey. It can be a grocery store. It can be a movie rental place. It can be almost anything. And I wonder if you haven't created something of a monster here.
There's no question. There is a tsunami of surveys that's just overwhelming. And I think of it as a little bit of a pollution effect that we have to find a way to overcome.
What do you make of this world we're in then, where you have Yelp reviews and Amazon reviews and people get rated all the time online?
The intentions are excellent, but I see too many of these, including Yelp and Amazon, where it appears to me that at least a third of the reviews are fake and they have intention behind them. When I wrote the first book and saw reviews that were completely negative, I saw that these were competitors of mine that just didn't like my business. It wasn't that the book was bad. And I think everyone in the marketplace faces this. Gee, I want my mother-in-law to write a positive review for me, and the competitors are out there slamming me. So this issue of credibility, I think, is an enormous one.
All right. So what's the last, without naming any names necessarily, unless you want to, what's the last lousy consumer experience you had, and what'd you do about it?
Oh, dear. I suppose it was this weekend when I went and bought a new car. And we went through this terrible negotiation process where people lie and misrepresent and just gets it off on a horrible footing. And then you get this this pressure that you got to give them a 10 or they're going to lose their job. I think.
So what'd you do?
I called up the head of the company and I said, this system is well-intentioned, but you've got to change it.
So you got your customer survey satisfaction thing, and you drummed up some consulting business.
Well, I'm not sure if there are any business, but my long-term goal in life is to have an impact, and I think I might.
Mr. Reichel, thanks very much for your time, sir.
It's my pleasure. Thank you.
Final note on the way out today, a little bit ew, and a little bit misplaced nostalgia, the Playboy Mansion here in L.A. has been sold. The buyer is a 32-year-old private equity guy who's one of the owners of the new Hostess Twinkie brand, by the way. Bought the snack maker out of bankruptcy a couple of years ago. The listing price for the mansion was $200 million. 12 bedrooms, a wine cellar, a theater, a gym, tennis courts, and that grotto. It is also apparently one of the few private residences in Los Angeles with a zoo license. And it comes with a 90-year-old man. A condition of the sale is the Playboy founder Hugh Hefner gets to stay as long as he wants, which is right there, the ew and the misplaced nostalgia right there. The Dow up 66 points today, 0.3%, 18,005 for all that is worth. The NASDAQ up 12 points, 0.25%. The S&P 500 gained 0.3%, 6 points. Chris Clark, Brad Fisher, Jake Gorski, Bill Lance, Jeff Peters, Daniel Ramirez, Charlton Thorpe, and Ben Holliday engineered the broadcast for us. I'm Kai Rizdahl. We'll see you tomorrow, everybody. This is APM.